The scripture reading this morning is from Luke chapter 7, verses 36 through 40. Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. As he went to the Pharisee's house, and he sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table with the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil, and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet, and anointed them with the fragrant oil. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, This man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answered and said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. So he said, Teacher, say it.
Morning. If you'll give me just a moment, I want to say a word of thanks to everybody who's helped out with the camp in big and small ways. People who are here for work days, people who have worked all spring, people who have donated generously, people who have helped quietly, people who will be there all week, people who are glad they won't be here at all that week. All of you, every one of you, cookie makers all, we appreciate every one of you. It makes it possible. It is a huge team effort, and all of you are a big part of that. Those of us who have done it a couple of times, Van and Marcia and I and Celine started in 2003, and we said, well, we'll direct a year, and no one's let us off the hook yet, Van, so we're still waiting for that. And we know what it's like to do it more or less by ourselves, and we know what it's like to have help, and it's a lot more fun with help. It's a lot more fun, so we appreciate all that you do, and it makes it possible for a lot of kids to be benefited. I'm one of them. I went to camp for, I don't know, nearly 10 years as a camper with Randy Brown and Jim Pinkston as directors and so forth, and have been benefited in a lot of ways by what goes on out there. It is an honor for me to get to take Jim Pinkston's whistle with me to camp when we go. That's probably been in charge, as I said on Facebook the other day, it's been in charge longer than I have been alive. That whistle has some power. So it's a great privilege to be a part of it and for this congregation to continue to support it. We appreciate it. We're going to continue our series on Jesus and the weak. And when we say Jesus and the weak, again, we don't mean that in an insulting way. We just mean what happens when Jesus encounters some sort of human weakness, very human weaknesses. In the book of Luke, where we're looking, will be in chapter 7 again today. We've seen kind of a string of very common human weaknesses because we humans have weaknesses. If we were strong enough, we wouldn't need anybody else, but we do. And so these weaknesses, we maybe try to rename them or hide them or feel better about them, but ultimately our question when we come to the gospel is, what is God going to do about me? Because I haven't been doing it myself. What about my weakness? And we've been looking at Jesus interacting with people on an individual level. Right? These aren't big crowds. This is important. Those would make good stories too. If Jesus looked at a big crowd and said, you're all weak, here's what we're going to do, that'd be fascinating. But these are on an individual level so that you personally can identify with the character in the story and say, I understand what that is like. Here's what Jesus says to me. Very personal. This is Jesus and the weak. And the weakness we're going to consider this time, I find to be interesting. This is, I know preachers say this all the time, it's one of my favorite stories, one of like 700 favorite stories in the Bible, but it's one of my favorite. I preach on it anytime I get a chance because of some of the details in it. I like to connect it to the story of Hagar. I think it's a great story for a lot of purposes. But we're going to take a look at the story in Luke chapter 7, and the weakness that we're going to look at is being invisible. And what we mean by that, we might think of being invisible as a superpower, which is what people think who are visible. If you're actually invisible, you know that's actually a pain. What does it mean to be invisible? In any culture, there are some people who are highly visible. So let's think for a moment about just American culture. Who's highly visible right now? Well, just because of what time of year it is and what year it is in the cycle, there are two people who are the presumptive nominees for two very large political parties. They are very visible. They have, you know their face, you know their names, you know part of their biography sketch, you know their position on issues. You could go to any town in America and say, who is this person? And hold up a picture of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, and they'd say, oh, that's who that is. Hold up my picture, probably not so much, right? They're not going to know who I am. They know who these people are. They're highly visible. What makes a person visible? Well, their social status, how important they are in political power, wealth. Okay, wealthy people are more visible. We see them. We're interested in them. If you go down Walmart and there's the aisle of the magazines, you know, and People magazine, what people? Well, not boring people. There's no pictures of me in People magazine. It's the visible people, right? It's the people that we're interested in, movie stars and athletes and things like this. That makes a person visible. But then there's lots of layers all the way down to where we might call a strata of people invisible, the people that we aren't as interested in. We don't put them in magazines. We don't put them on the news. We don't care about them a whole lot. It's not that we're malicious towards them. We don't hate them necessarily. They're just not particularly important. And what makes a person invisible? Well, maybe lots of things. If wealth makes you visible, poverty might make you invisible. If power makes you visible, powerlessness might make you invisible. And because of those two things, in a lot of cultures, race, right? And we've had times in American culture that we're getting better at, but we've had times in our past where there was a race that we kind of pretended wasn't there, that we had a job for, but we mostly wanted to ignore. So race in some cultures can make a person more or less invisible. Other things like that. Your status. I was reading something the other day that just happened to be on this theme, and I wasn't even realizing I was going to get there, but it made the comment that relates to last week's lesson. In American culture, one of the most invisible groups is the widow. It turns out in historical human culture, that's always been true. Read the old prophets. And then God is always beating the drum saying, pay attention to the widows. Why does God have to keep saying that? Because no one's paying attention to the widows. It was easy to say, well, they've outlived their usefulness and we'll ignore them now. Let's pay attention to these other people. So there are people in any culture. There are people in any church that are more visible. Okay, so in American culture, I'm one of the less visible people. But in a church, most of you probably could tell me somebody my name, right? Well, yeah, that's the preacher. We know him. But if I pointed to some random person in the auditorium, maybe not so easy, right? So we have that in a church. And we have people that we notice and people we don't notice and people we prefer not to notice. And what do I mean by that? I mean hatefully. But there are people whose mere presence sometimes makes us uncomfortable. And we say we just don't want to know about them. We don't ask their name. Isn't that interesting? Two people walk into a church building. We might ask, who is that person, about one and not the other? And we've all done it. Why? Why do we look past one and look directly at the other? There are some people who are just easier to see. They make us feel comfortable. And some people make us feel uncomfortable. That just happens. It's part of life. It's not good. James chapter 2 is the chapter you want to read about it. He says one person comes in with bright, shiny clothes, and you say, hey, have this good seat right here. Another person comes in, and they smell a little bit, and you say, well, there's a spot over there. Okay, this is the way humans are wired, and it's not good. In the ancient world, this was the same way. With one more step, the ancient people thought the gods were the same way. The gods were very interested in highly visible, important people. The gods might care about what kings and emperors and generals and war heroes and rich people did. Gods didn't care so much about what little people did, the invisible person. And so one of the bizarre qualities of the God of Israel is his insistence throughout the Old Testament that he cares most of all about widows and orphans, about the oppressed, about slaves in Egypt, but maybe not Pharaoh. That he has it completely upside down from the way that people saw their world. Jesus does the same thing. And in this story we're going to read in Luke chapter 7, Jesus is going to interact with two people, some of whom are visible and some of whom are not. Now this is interesting on another level because Luke's gospel, and if I wish I had another hour to talk about this because this is just a subtle feature of Luke. Go read it sometime and look for this. When you read Luke's gospel, watch how many times Luke talks about seeing something. It constantly comes up. Constantly comes up in Luke. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus is in the synagogue and he picks up the big Isaiah scroll and he turns over and he reads a passage. And what passage does he read? It's about the year of the Lord's favor and about the recovering of sight of the blind. And then he sits down and says, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. Jesus is someone who has come to give the blind their sight back. And then in stories throughout, last week in Luke chapter 7, Jesus met the widow of Nain. And the first thing that Luke says, there's this funeral procession going by, and it says, and Jesus saw her. Big crowd of people, Jesus saw her in her grief and responds to it. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, in a couple of chapters in Luke chapter 10. Now, by chance, a priest was going by down the road, and he saw him. Remember, there's a man who's been beaten up and mugged and robbed, and he's on the side of the road, half dead. He saw him. He passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. Luke could have just said, well, there were three guys that passed by, and here's what happened. But each time, he wants you to know, they saw him. They noticed. Which one really saw him? Two men saw someone to pass by. One man saw him and had compassion. This is the way Luke tells stories. And at the end of the gospel, in Luke 24, we have the resurrection scene, and some disciples are walking down the road to Emmaus. And as they're walking down the road, some stranger comes to them and says, where are you going? What are you doing? Oh, we're out traveling around. Strange things happened in Jerusalem. This person named Jesus of Nazareth was crucified, and now his tomb is empty, and we don't know what's going on. And they walk all the way down the road, and they're telling the stranger the story of Jesus. And they get to some place, they stop, and they have a meal, and it says in verse 31, and their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. The stranger they had been talking to was Jesus, and he vanished from their sight. So Luke's gospel, it's just a strange little theme about what do you see, and how does God see you? And it comes up a lot, over and over again, in little places throughout the book, of people getting to see what God sees. And that's a lot about what this story is about. In Luke chapter 7, we're going to begin in verse 36. Just set the very simple story. It says, one of the Pharisees asked him, this is Jesus, to eat with him. And he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment. And standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head and kissed his feet and anointed him with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. Okay, so straightforward. There's three main characters in the story. Let's look at them. First of all, we know who Jesus is, we think, so let's move to the other one. Who is this Pharisee? He gets a name later. His name is Simon. I didn't mention that in those verses, but in a minute it will. His name is Simon. And who is he? Who is a Pharisee? I think I've told you this joke before, but I have had a professor who always threatened to make a shirt that said, give the Pharisees a break, because we think we know who the Pharisees are, and we probably don't. Who are the Pharisees? They're a group within Judaism of that time that was very concerned with cleanliness and ceremonial purity. Okay, that's the best way to understand them. All Jewish folk at some level were concerned about this. But you didn't have to be clean all the time. Okay? I think we misunderstand that. To be unclean doesn't mean you're in sin. To be unclean just meant you were ceremonial and unclean. Sometimes it was necessary to be unclean. You know, if you touch a dead body in Jewish culture, you're unclean. Well, somebody has to touch the body. Somebody has to bury the body. I mean, it just has to happen. So it's okay. You were supposed to go through a process now to become clean. You weren't in sin. You were unclean. You weren't supposed to go to the temple that day. Okay? Unless you're a Pharisee. The Pharisees tried to live their life in such a way so that every day, it doesn't matter if they're 600 miles away from Jerusalem, at that moment they could take a step and walk into the temple. They wanted to live lives of that level of cleanliness, of ceremonial purity, that at any moment they could stand in the temple and say, I'm ready. Okay? And on a practical level, that was very difficult. Because as I just said, there are things that happen in ordinary life that make you unclean. So the Pharisees, by the tradition of their fathers and forefathers and teachers and rabbis and elders, had come up with an elaborate system of rules and conditions for what made you clean and what made you not clean. It wasn't malicious. It wasn't evil. It was about purity. If Jewish folks are cleanliness experts, the Pharisee is the Jedi of cleanliness. They are the absolute top of the masters of what it means to be clean. In every situation, they know exactly what they're supposed to do. Okay. This person, this particular Pharisee, is also apparently a prominent person in his community. How do I know that? Because he can invite Jesus over for dinner. Jesus himself has made some notoriety for himself. He's not important in a lot of people's minds because he's not wealthy, he's not powerful, has no status, but he's well known, and so he has some notoriety. This person is important enough, he can invite him over for dinner. Remember earlier in chapter 7, 2 weeks ago, we had a sermon about the centurion, and the centurion said, "I am not worthy to have you into my home." Centurion, Roman official, "I'm not worthy to have you into my home." Pharisee didn't feel that way. Simon the Pharisee says, "Oh yeah, I'll have him over for dinner." In fact, we'll kind of make a thing of it. It has the feel that this is not an intimate meal, right? This is not like Nicodemus in John chapter 3, who comes to him by night with really important questions. And, "Master, we know thou art a teacher come from God. Could you tell me more?" Doesn't have that feel, does it? He has him over, and he's showing his hospitality and his public status. "I can have Jesus over. We can have a meal." And apparently there are other people there. How do I know that? Because this strange woman comes in. Let me make my point here. How often does someone walk into your house during dinner and you don't notice? Okay? That's a strange event. And so I was checking some of the commentaries, and several of them had the question, "We don't really know how this woman gets in the house." My suggestion is, this is not a simple meal. This is a banquet. There are lots of people coming and going, and with this crowd, in comes this woman, okay, that she had heard of it. Okay. So Simon is putting on quite a show, quite a to-do, and he has invited Jesus. What does that tell us about Simon? Unlike the centurion who says, "I'm unworthy to have you in my home," Simon thinks of himself in terms of social status as Jesus' equal. Maybe he's better. But he can show hospitality to Jesus and invite him into his home. What does the Pharisee expect from Jesus? We don't get this in the text, but we can kind of surmise. He expects him to be a good guest. He expects him to come in at the table, to respond to his hospitality with graciousness and honor, and to raise the status of the Pharisee a little bit because he had Jesus in his house, right? You're now the person who had Jesus in your house. So this helps him out a little bit. He has some expectations of what he wants. And he expects Jesus to behave a certain way, which in this story includes not being touched by a sinner. Okay? So who is the sinner? Well, that's an interesting question. She gets no name in the story. Okay? What did she do? We also have no idea. I get to wag my fingers at the commentators a little bit. The commentators have all figured it out. They all know exactly. I have no idea. The text doesn't tell you. There's always speculation she could have been a prostitute or something like that. That's certainly possible. But the text doesn't tell you. But it does tell you this. She was a sinner and people knew it. Okay? I've done some bad things in my life, but when I walk in the door, people don't go, "There goes a sinner." Okay? Usually. Okay? What do you have to do in a community to be such a person that you walk in the front door and say, "There's a sinner"? Okay? She had done something. That's why prostitute always comes up, because that might be the kind of person that the community would know, "Oh, yeah, her." But it could have been she robbed a bank. I don't have any idea. But she is a person whose sin was sufficiently notable that she had notoriety. We don't even know her name, but we know she's bad. We recognize her by face value. She's interesting because she's both visible and invisible all at once. She's invisible as a person. I don't know her name. I don't know her family. I don't know her story. I don't know what she cares about in life. I don't know what troubles she has. But she's highly visible in the fact that we know she's bad. I would bet, if I were a betting man, that you could ask Simon the Pharisee, "What do you know about that woman?" And "She's a sinner" might be all he could tell you. That's what they knew about this woman. What does the sinner expect from Jesus? nothing. She doesn't come into the house with an expectation that he bestow on her any honor. Quite the opposite. She comes into the home with the expectation that maybe she could sneak in and do him an honor. Not just an honor, an extravagant honor. An awkward honor. Even in the ancient world, and I know this is kind of a strange foreign world and it's different from ours, even in the ancient world, this story is strange. A person you don't know just doesn't come in and start touching you. Okay? They don't come in and start wiping your feet. And if they do, they don't do it with their hair and with their tears and a very expensive container of ointment. This is borderline inappropriate. In fact, it's not borderline. It's inappropriate. For a woman to touch a man who is not her family, a woman who already has a reputation, in public, in this kind of intimate way, just completely inappropriate, certainly by Simon the Pharisee standards and by probably everybody else at the table. It's just not done. Again, try to imagine yourself in that situation. Okay? So her act is extravagantly, awkwardly honoring Jesus. But she doesn't seem to expect anything. She doesn't ask for anything. As far as we can tell, she doesn't say anything. She just comes in and wants to do him an honor. Why? Because she heard he was in town. That's all Luke tells you. She heard he was here, and so she comes. What did the Pharisee see when that happens? In verse 39, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, Luke wants to mention, eyes here. Okay. He saw this and he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. The Pharisee sees two things. He sees a sinner and a charlatan. A sinner is all this woman is. And when he looks at Jesus, if Jesus was who he says he is, if he was a prophet, if he was any kind of person with any kind of knowledge or guidance from God, he would know what kind of woman this is. He's a fake. He's a fraud. Now, interestingly enough, Luke points out, he says all this to himself. He doesn't say this out loud. Because, again, this isn't about reality. This is about attaining honor. I had someone important over, and now I'm going to sit quietly and judge them while they eat, right? And so inside of his head, he's saying, yeah, prophet, sure you are. And that's what he sees in this particular scenario. So let's keep reading, beginning in verse 40. What happens? Jesus decides to tell a story. And Jesus answering said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And I always want the next line to read. And Simon wisely said, please, please don't say anything. This sounds dangerous. When Jesus says, something I'd like to say. This is going to go in a bad direction in a hurry. But Simon says, say it, teacher. Say whatever it is you had to say. I'm not afraid of anything. Go ahead and tell me what there's to say. Because he's smug and superior, right? He doesn't have to worry about it. This is a charlatan. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's already shamed himself at the table. He's embarrassing himself. Yeah, say whatever it is you have to say. And so Jesus tells the story. A certain money lender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which one of them will love him more? Simon answered, the one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. And he said to him, you have judged rightly, which is the more ominous statement. You're right about that. Here it comes. Right, here it comes. You're right about that. Now I'm going to tell you something else. But let's look at the story just for a moment. Denarii in this culture is about a day's wage for a day laborer. So you don't have to do any math to figure out what does a denarii convert into dollars. Think for a moment about what you make in a day. Think about your paycheck, divide it up. What's a day of work worth to you? 500 days worth. That's more than you work in a year. Okay. One person has a 500-day debt, 500-work-day. If they took every penny they made, didn't buy food, didn't buy anything, every penny they made for 500 days, put it in a bucket, they could hand it back, that would be the debt. The other person has 50 days debt. Now, 50 days debt, that's not a small debt, right? You're working a month and a half for somebody else. 2 months almost. Yeah, that's not a small debt by any stretch. But 500 days. The idea that you could take every penny you make for an entire year and give it to your creditor and still owe them quite a lot of money. That's a lot of money. With interest, if there was interest involved, and I don't know if it says that or not, but if there was interest involved, this is just an insurmountable debt. This can't be paid. One's a large debt. One's an outrageously large debt. Both of these are forgiven. Both have a debt. Both are forgiven. And Jesus' question is, by the way, notice the questions he doesn't ask. He doesn't say who was forgiven the larger debt. He doesn't say who is the better person. He doesn't say was this right, was this wrong. He just says, if this happened, who would love more? In reality, who would love more? He doesn't even say it's right. He doesn't say it's good for one of you to love more than the other, right? He just says, in reality, ordinary situation, who is more excited? Who loves more? Okay. And Simon, I think at this point, is getting a little edgy because he's catch that I suppose. Well, I suppose. That's what you say when you really want to leave yourself an out for later, when you don't like your own answer. But he says, yeah, clearly it's the person with the larger debt. Where is Jesus going with this? Oh, it's going to get bad in a hurry. Begin in verse 44. Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, that's a little awkward. Think about that moment. He's talking to Simon. This is the host. I'm speaking to the host. And then he starts looking at someone else, but still talking to Simon. Okay. He turns to the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? And that's the question. I'm convinced that's the big hammer here. Okay, do you see this woman? He hadn't. He had never seen a person. He saw a sinner. He saw a contagion that had entered his house and was now embarrassing his guests. He saw someone who was making a fool out of Jesus. But that's all he had seen when this person enters the house. Jesus says, do you even see this woman? And Jesus, to demonstrate that he does, turns and looks directly at her while talking to the Pharisee. Can you even recognize that she's here and what she's worth? The Pharisee could not see the woman at all, only a sinner, but that's not all. The Pharisee didn't see Jesus for who he was. Look at the end of this verse. Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with oil. What's Jesus' point? This person had not even seen Jesus as a person to whom hospitality was due. In the ancient world, it didn't always happen. But quite often, if you were a polite fella, you would offer to clean a person's feet that were sandals. The streets were dirty. And so you'd offer to clean up before dinner, especially because how did they eat? If you read the verse previously, they reclined at the table. Your feet was near somebody else's food. And so it was just polite to clean up somebody's feet, offer them some water to wash their hands, to clean up. And then if you want to show them extraordinary honor, maybe put some oil on their head to soothe after the heat of the day and all. These are things you might do if you honored a person. Jesus says, you didn't even show me ordinary honor. Why not? Because the Pharisee from day one has considered himself superior to Jesus. The Pharisee has only invited Jesus in not to be blessed by Jesus' presence, but to gain the notoriety of having a famous person in his house. And while Jesus eats, he sits back smugly and judges him. Well, if he's a prophet, he'd know who that was. That's the Pharisee's whole intent. Jesus says, you are too busy being smug to take the time to notice this woman. You barely noticed me. You couldn't show me ordinary hospitality. But what about this woman? She hasn't ceased. She won't stop. And that's, again, getting to the point. It was getting a little bit awkward. Jesus says, she hasn't even stopped. She just keeps going. That's the gushing, extraordinary compassion and affection she has toward Jesus. The Pharisee cannot see the woman at all. He can't see Jesus as a person worthy of honor or hospitality. The Pharisee could not see a person to love. Verse 47, "Therefore I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little." I'm going to insert Ben's think so here, so just be careful with this. Grain of salt, okay? I don't think Jesus is saying, "Pharisee, you just don't have as many sins as her, and that's why you don't love me very much." I think Jesus is saying, "You don't think you have very many sins." If you read the stories about Jesus associating with sinners, and you think those stories mean you should associate with more sinners, you don't understand who you are in those stories. Jesus associating with sinners is Jesus showing you that he can associate with you because you're one of them. The Pharisee said, "Look, he's touching a sinner." Jesus says, "Who do you think you are? I've been eating with sinners all day." And the Pharisees didn't get that. Can you even see this woman? You couldn't show the Lord of the universe hospitality. She can't stop. And that's the difference between how Jesus sees this and we do. We see visible people and invisible people. People who can do things for us and people who can't. People we deem as important and people we don't. Jesus sees people. What kind of people? Sinful people. Every last one of them. You didn't have to tell Jesus that she was a sinner. You think he didn't know that? They all were. And he knows that. The difference is there's one person in the room that doesn't know it, and it's the Pharisee. The Pharisee doesn't realize this. Jesus in this story, let me say it like this, the Pharisee saw one sinner in this story. Jesus saw two. Jesus saw two. And that's the difference of how God sees every one of us. He does not see the need of social status and he doesn't see the prosperity that makes us think we're so great or the hubris that fills our hearts. He sees the need of human sin and our place before God. And he sees that in every one of us the same. The Pharisee saw one sinner. Jesus saw two. The irony is, at the end of the story, the Pharisee's right. There's one sinner in the room, but it's not that woman. Read verse 47 through 48. "Therefore I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. And he said to her, 'Your sins are forgiven.' Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, 'Who is this who even forgives sins?' And he said to the woman, 'Your faith has saved you. Go in peace.'" When Jesus looks at the man, he sees a smug, condescending individual. When he looks at the woman, he sees faith. He sees love. He sees recognition of her sins. A person in desperate need. This is important too. Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, she doesn't have any sins." He says her sins are forgiven. She has many. But because of her recognition of need, because of her faith, because of her love, because of her affection and her willingness to bow down before the Lord of the universe, who is willing to be merciful and forgive, that woman walks away forgiven. The Pharisee is right where he was when the dinner started. Bruce had an interesting article in this today's bulletin. I'll give you the punchline if you haven't read it already. Where do sinners go? Church. Okay? A person who is in need needs to come to Jesus Christ, and that's what we're supposed to be here for. This is not a dinner table where we sit around condescendingly looking at everybody else and wondering why they aren't as good as we think they ought to be. And if they were as good as we thought they ought to be, they wouldn't be here in the front. I don't know. It's not the way it works. Jesus sees us for what we actually are. And it's time for us to see Jesus as he actually is. What do they see in Jesus? The Pharisee saw a man of notoriety who could come and bestow status upon him. At the end of the day, what did the people see? What manner of man is this that even forgives sins? That's what kind of man he is. There's exactly one person in all the universe who can magnanimously and mercifully forgive the sins of other people as if all the sins of the universe were against him, because they are. And that person had come to dinner. That person is inviting you today. That person sees you not as the invisible person you might see yourself, not as your strata in the social network, not as your wealth or your prosperity or lack thereof. He sees a person in deep weakness and human need, and he has come for you. And if you think that you can sit there in smug satisfaction and judge those who are in desperate need of Christ, he's coming for you too, and it's not as pretty. Hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, see what he sees, and respond to it with love and affection and tears. As we stand and sing the gospel invitation, won't you come at this time?